Accession number 14968, Reel 2.
Mr. Adams, Reel 2.
This trap, as I was saying, was the coal hole. And when the coalmen delivered, they would lift this trap and pour the coal through the hole into the area. But what a lot of people did, they were advised to do so by the air raid precautions people, was to use the area or the basement as a shelter because it was under the pavement. So the first house we had an area, and the coal was pushed to one side and fenced off with wood and panelling. And my father whitewashed the rest of the area. And in the area we had bunks and a table and some chairs and a kettle, so as we could go into this area at night and live in this cellar affair. Well, when that house was hit, this was in Shrublin Road before we moved to Trellerim Road in the early part of the war. When that house was hit, literally the bomb dropped in the street, so it blew the house to pieces. Nothing was left. We went up the stairs of this area to try to get out, and we couldn't because the door was piled up with bricks and where the house had come down, literally upon us. We couldn't push the door open, but the wardens and the rescue people had cleared the street and they were lifting these metal traps. And what they did, they had a metal bar and they would bang on the trap on the top, on the pavement. And we were inside, and I recall my father, this is before he was called up, had a long stick with a hammerhead on it, and he rattled from inside to let them know we were there. And they took the trap off, and the daylight come flooding in, and they pulled us out through that hole onto the pavement. They dropped a ladder down, and that's how we got out. That was a bomb-damaged house, totally wrecked.
So that was more frightening.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I remember that distinctly, getting out of the coal hole on a ladder with the ARP men, because the house was destroyed. Yeah.
What was that address? Do you remember?
Yeah, that was Shrublin Road. I don't remember the number, but it was quite near Dawson Bus Garage, actually.
Do you know when you moved from Shrublin Road to Tredowin?
Tredowin? 39. We were in Shrublin at the outbreak of war, so it must have been the latter part of 39 into 40. Yes, it must have been the latter part of 39 or early in 1940.
I think that date perhaps is wrong because, as far as I understand it, the bombing really started in September 1940.
Yep. So I'm a year out, aren't I? We lived in Shrublin Road at the early part of the war and that was bombed out. So that would be when the bombing started.
Well, bombing started, I think, in London in September 40.
40. So it'll be the turn of that year when we move to Trenewin.
Turn of 40-41.
Yes, I'm a year out, yes.
Any other incidents that you remember from the bombing as they affected you?
Family-wise? Yeah. No. Shrublin Road we were bombed out. Trenewin Road we were blasted quite heavily. And we had the Anderson shelter. There was the things about the bombing. We had London Fields quite close by, where the barrage balloon was, and we used to go up there, and we all, being young lads, we all became very friendly with the WAFs, or the girls who flew the balloon. We spent a lot of time up there with the balloon girls, with the barrage balloon, yeah. That was interesting. Victoria Park, where the guns were, the Beaufort guns, we used to go over there and see them. You could see them.
Coming back to the Blitz, mm-hmm. How did you feel that the emergency services were coping? Did they manage to get the fires out, or were they ever overwhelmed by what had happened?
They were obviously very stretched, because most men had been called up and were in services. And lots of women turned their hand to driving vehicles in the war years. And you had the fire brigades, NSF it was called, wasn't it? NSF, yes. And they had water tanks all over the place. and they would come along with the fire engines with trailers on, a little trailer on the back with a motor on it, a two-wheeled trailer. And they would use these big water tanks, which were made of metal, and I remember it was painted grey, and on the side it had EWS, Emergency Water Supply. Of course, the kids all used to play in them. We used to float boats in them, and God knows what all else. We didn't realise what they were for. And they put wire, they put chicken wire covers over them to protect them. But I don't think they, you can't say they didn't cope, because those services were stretched to the limit. We never had any outrageous continual fires where we lived, no. Everything seemed to be under control. It was in the city where, you've seen the photographs of the Blitz, it was in the city where it was tighter for them. Hackney, Dalston, Bethnal Green, which is our area, Victoria Park, Shoreditch, Kingsland Road, all this area down towards Liverpool Street Station and out to Stamford Hill, that was our area, so to speak. And we got quite a bombing, but I don't recall any continual fires going on. So the brigade, for what it was, how stretched it was, must have done well. And also, the wardens did a lot, because they had to block off streets when a bomb dropped and you had a crater, as I said earlier, thus exposing gas pipes and water pipes and electric cabling. They did well as well, the wardens and all those services. I remember the ladies, I suppose there would be WVS, would come round with a van, and the side would open up and they would serve tea and lemonade and rolls and sandwiches to people who had been bombed out. I recall seeing that, where people had been bombed out and they were assisted to find their belongings in the houses, and the WVS and the voluntary service would come round and provide meals and food. Or in Mare Street, Hackney, the cinemas were converted. The Regal at Wells Street was altered, and the Empress by the Air Raid Precautions Office, the ARP offices. And if you got bombed out, you went to these places, and I understood that you were given some items of crockery, pots and pans, and things to help you set up again if you could find somewhere else to live. That was the situation after the bombing, if one got blitzed out, or bombed out, as it was called.
Did that happen to your family after you were bombed out at Shrubland Road?
Yes. I recall my parents went to this place in Mare Street, Hackney, and with the assistance of the women, it must have been the WVS, and the ARP, the Air Raid Precautions Office, and, of course, local friends who submitted various things to you. We got this place to live in Tredwen Road, after Shrubland, and lots of things were given to you. People were entirely different in those days. I don't recall locking doors and things like that, because people were so different. It was much more friendly in those days. People lived for each other. It was much closer camaraderie, because were you going to see each other tomorrow? That was the thing. I do recall people sitting outside their houses in the dusk, 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night, with pots of tea, bottles of beer, having a smoke and a chat, sitting talking at the front doors, and always the chairs came out, and they sat talking, and then when it became dark or the siren went, it would all be packed up and you'd go to your shelters. And I can recall people having a drink or a cup of tea and a cigarette together outside their houses, talking, and when it was time to go, you didn't get good night. I saw people shaking hands and saying, God bless, hope to see you tomorrow. That's how people lived. But you were much closer. It was camaraderie. And the street shelters were quite fun as well, because lots of people used to take crates of beer in with them. And there was usually a piano got in there somehow, or someone could play an accordion, that was the instrument of the day. And they used to have sing-songs in these shelters till quite a late hour. And I think it was to entertain themselves, to take their mind off the noise, or to pacify the kids, to keep them, get them to sleep. I don't know what it was, but it was a camaraderie. It was something that sprung up, which was so great. It was so close. And you could hear these street parties going on in these shelters at night. Someone playing an accordion, as I say, or a piano, and they'd take drinking with them. And they'd all brewing up equipment for tea. I can remember that.
Do you remember any of the songs they would typically sing?
Oh, typical Cockney songs. All the Cockney songs would come out, the musical stuff. And of course the songs that one was taking the mickey out of, the Hun and Hitler and all those sort of songs where they were laughing at Adolf Hitler and Mussolini. Because at the outset of the war, everyone was afraid of this name, this Adolf Hitler and the Germans and Germany. It had a frightening ring because they were the people we were fighting. Wow. But as the war progressed, and it was the coming of people like Tommy Handley, who made a joke of the man, or who made a joke of the situation. Mussolini was quite often laughed at, and Hitler, Adolf Hitler, being, someone said he was a painter, a house painter. And you got lots of jokes about this man, this Schuckel Gruber, with a funny name. So it became lighter. And my father also, prior to going in the Royal Air Force, used to build radios. And he built me a crystal set. And he used to build valve sets with batteries and whatnot. Of course, we could tune in at night and listen to this Germany calling fella. And that became a joke, with this man giving out all this information about British troops and British towns and British aircraft, and people would laugh at it because his facts were always wrong, or they seemed to be wrong. And then, again, Tommy Handley brought the point to light about this man. We used to hear him say, Germany calling, Germany calling. And then Tommy Handley come out with, this is Funf speaking. Well, of course, the man was then ridiculed. And one would say in the street, you'd go out in the street and say, did you hear Funf last night, hear what you had to say? So it became light-hearted as the war went on. But of course, after the Blitz, people just hadn't got over that when this other dreadful thing started, the doodlebug. And we all got to know what that looked like and the sound. And again, your confidence grew as it went on because we were petrified of them at the outset. But we soon learned that if you watch them, I often watch doodlebugs fly by. If it cut off above you, you had to move, you had to go for cover. But if it went past you and shut off, or it shut off before it got to you, we knew it would, by what we were told and we'd seen, it would shut off and fall out of the sky. And I did watch doodlebugs fly by. And that sound, again, there was a thing like the Hurricane and the Spitfire and the German bombers, you knew the sound. It was a burbling sound, a raspberry-type sound. And I watched doodlebugs fly across, as everybody did. We used to stand and watch them. And if it shut off or it was coming your way, run like hell and dive in something, a doorway or something. So this was the episode of the doodlebug. Again, we lived through it.
Did any V1s fall near you?
I believe one fell in Mare Street in Hackney. One fell in Mare Street. One fell in Whiston Road. There was one in Queensbridge Road. They did fall around, yes, they did.
You haven't mentioned the V2s, the rocket.
Well, that followed. That was the next thing. That was the fearful thing because there was no sight nor sound of that at all. That followed the V1. You see, as we're relating this and talking this, we're going through the stages of the fear and the realisation and then the boldness of the Blitz and the faith in the Anderson shelter and the faith in your local armament like the Bofa guns and the Park guns and the Navy guns. And then the next sequence was the doodlebug, the feared black thing that would shut off and drop upon you. But then, when you knew about it, you watched it, and you became aware of it, so your confidence grew. But the rocket, the V2 was something else. You didn't know, you couldn't see it nor hear it, it just came. And one of those landed in Mare Street. Yeah, I recall a V2 landed in Mare Street in Hackney.
What did it destroy?
That was quite near the Empress Cinema. There was a park and loads of shops, of course, and all the tram lines came up and the cables for the trolley buses came down. And that was a frightening thing, the rocket, because there was no clue. The other thing I remember about the war was the stuff they used to drop out of aircraft. It was like a magnetic metallic tape. You could see it fluttering down in the sunlight. Now this, I think, was to deflect radar beams. I can recall picking that up in the street because one thought it was like a bit of a Christmas decoration. Silver strips it was. Yeah.
What did you do with all these things that you collected? You must have had a house
club. Well, it became a swap thing. I've got a cartridge case. Will you swap it for your piece of shrapnel? Or my incendiary bomber fin for your nose cap of something? Or a reel of tape for something else? And lots of it went to schools, I believe. Schools collected it to keep as a war museum. That's where mine most went, to schools. And when I got older, scouts, I think, sea cadets, things went to those places as war memorabilia. The very early days, of course, just after the war we're talking. I recall the gunning in the war with the Beaufort guns. That was quite clear over Victoria Park. There was quite a story about the railway line that comes out of Liverpool Street. It comes out of Liverpool Street, Bethnal Green, Hampstead Heath, London Fields, and out to Chingford. And they put this naval, by all accounts, they put this naval gun. This was some kind of big gun. And they put this naval gun on the track to fire at the aircraft. The story goes that this gun, was on the railway track at London Fields Station. And I don't know what shell it fired, but when it went off, the recoil was so great from when they fired it, that the carriage it was on was catapulted some 75 to 80 yards down the track. Hence was the recoil of this gun. And the prophecy was, rather than have the gun in line with the carriage it was on, or the truck it was on, in line with the track, turn it at 90 degrees and it wouldn't, by recoil, go whistling down the track. And it was fired at the other angle, and it immediately came off the track because of the recoil and the wheels being lipped. It came off the track and took off the track with it. This was the story of the naval gun. It was some big gun.
So it destroyed the track?
It destroyed the track where it was standing. These are the things we heard, yes.
Did you live all the time throughout the war in Dalston, or did you move out?
No, we lived all the time.
Why did your family not consider evacuating?
Well, my father was called up, like most men, for the Royal Air Force, leaving my mother and I and the lady upstairs, who was called Mrs. Pierce, in Tredavin Road. And here again, you were at this place called home, where you lived, to be in that place, as everybody did. I mean, all our neighbours and all the kids in the street all stayed there, the whole street. And all the boys were great friends, and all the girls were chased, and everybody knew each other. And it was your home. It was not like it is nowadays. People weren't itinerant in those days. People didn't move as freely. You had a place to live. This was your home. And also, my father was satisfied in the fact that he knew where my mother and I were, surrounded by all these people who we had befriended. It's the street. It was the street where you lived. That was how it was. People didn't evacuate and move.
How much difference did it make to you and the family when your father left?
My father was in the RF. Mum got a job in the shop where my father used to work, this Mumford's it was called, in the Broadway Market, Hackney. And I suppose one would nowadays call it employee perks, but because she worked in this shop, which was a grocery and provision shop, perhaps her butter and cheese and things were supplemented. We did live okay. Not exorbitant or rash by any means, because you often, with neighbours, went shopping with neighbours, and they would use their allocation, you would use your allocation, and being close friends with your neighbours as you were, lots of swaps and changes were taking place. And I recall Mum had a big tin, which would be about 15 or 18 inches tall and about 12 inches diameter. It must have been a fruit tin because it was clean inside. She would fill this with water and put loads of salt in it, and she would put eggs in it to make them last, by all accounts. The salt produced an extra shell around the shell of the eggs, and they lasted longer. I think it was called glassing them. Glassing the eggs. And they were immersed in this very, very salty water to keep them longer. Yes, I recall that.
How was your diet during the war? Did you suffer from lack of food?
No, I don't recall ever suffering. I recall lots of stews. I don't know how they came about, but there were lots of stews. I suppose it was potatoes and vegetables, because we had an allotment, as most people did, and you grew lots of stuff. No, I don't recall being lack of food or anything. Well, the proof is in the thing itself, because after the war, I took part in, like most boys did, sporting things. I mean, I used to fight for Eton Manor. I used to row for a racing club. So I was quite a fit and healthy youth, so it didn't mar me in any way as a lad, no.
Were there any foods which you couldn't get that you craved for?
I don't remember, because we were used to what we had. Perhaps it was because I was, as I say, born in 32, the war broke out in 39, so I was 7. I shouldn't think as a boy of that age I would have picked up all the cravings, so I was brought up on the ration thing. It was after the war, when the rationing slowly eased off and things got better, that you realised there were, I realised there were better things. I suppose during the war we had gotten used to what we could get. But it was afterwards, when we could get other things, wow, I haven't had this before. Perhaps I had, but I didn't remember. So you got used to the wartime diet, didn't you?
Could I go back to the bombing and ask you how you think public morale stood up in Dalston under the impact of all the attacks?
Life went on. That was the attitude that I felt. Life went on. It had to go on. Because you lived from day to day. And you would hear comments from people, such as, "What if we'll get a quiet night tonight? No, I expect it'll be over again. Let's hope it's not us. If only his bombs would fall in open spaces where no one would get hurt." Stuff like this. So it was a day-to-day life. And you were just thankful for being around. You were happier. With all that going on, there was a sense of security and happiness, yeah, because you were around. Obviously, you heard of people getting bombed out and people being killed and tragic things happening, like the Bethnal Green disaster, which was only caused through panic, the Bethnal Green tube station when all the people got trampled. You heard of these things, but it wasn't you. It affected you, but instantaneously it wasn't you. Oh God, someone else has copped it. And you could hear that when the bombs were dropping. when you could hear the explosions, people would say, someone's copped it. This is the expression. I wonder who got it tonight. And in the mornings, when the siren, the all clear would go, and you came out and you met people, you got jocular comments like, he missed us, didn't he? He missed us last night. He ain't got our address yet, and so on. So these things lightened it. And you also, you took an interest in the war. As a boy, girls perhaps attitudes were different. It was all making and mending, I think, with girls, like sewing and darning and making things, like curtains, because they got destroyed, and dresses because you couldn't get them. But boys, I suppose it was one damn great adventure, really. I had a map on the wall of Europe, and we used to listen to the broadcasts, particularly after the invasion. One got loads of ordinary pins, and you'd take a piece of paper, twice the size of a postage stamp, fold it in half, and paint it with our Union Jack, the American flag, the Russian flag, the German and the Italian flag, and you'd stick them all in the map on the pin. And when they said the British troops had landed at so-and-so and they were advanced to so-and-so, you'd move your pins on your map, and you had all the pins in the map with the flags on. So geographically you became interested in it. I mean, this is the latter part of the war. We were still being struck by the tail end of the V2s and the rockets, but we were now seeing daylight. We were on the winning side. We were in France, and the American flags and the English flags and the Russian flags were closing from the right, the Russians, and from the left, the English and the American flags, and up through Italy. And I could never understand why my flags had to go round Switzerland. I always remember saying that to someone. Nothing's happening in Switzerland, and I couldn't understand neutrality at that time. But I do now, of course. But I recall the flag slowly being moved across the map with the news broadcasts. When we'd taken this, taken that, moved the Union Jack, or moved the Stars and Stripes, and moved the hammer and sickles, and the German flag, the red flag with the white ring and the black swastika was gradually getting crushed in. Here was the... This is the ending. You think, we are on the winning side now. It will stop.
As far as you and your friends and so on were concerned, was there any hatred of the Germans, particularly of the pilots who were carrying out the bombing?
I don't think so, because you didn't know them as a person. It was the Germans. The Luftwaffe. And you learnt a lot of German words. I mean, I didn't know what Luftwaffe was until someone told me it was air warfare, Luftwaffe. And these funny aircraft names, we got to know them. I don't think you hated them. You hated them as a race, yeah. Not as an individual. And as you grow older, after the war, you thought, well, the guy was doing his job, he was told to do it. He was under orders, as our boys were under orders, to do the similar thing. It's just that we don't know how the Germans reacted to what we were doing. We only know how we felt at that time. Because I think we were so vulnerable as well. We obviously were not ready. And we were not aware of what one could do with an aircraft and a stick of bombs.
But with all this destruction about you, did it make you want revenge on the Germans?